Good morning, diners, travelers, drinkers, sun worshippers.
Drinkers? That's a nice way of going. We could at least say imbibers or enophiles or something classy like that, especially since we got back from a really classy city just a few days ago.
Right, and we found the spring not there but here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's right.
But we're going to be talking today about our friends in Charleston.
Everybody wants to know, spring has definitely sprung. The snow is all gone.
And we've got crocuses.
Because our crocuses are breaking through in the front garden. Isn't that wonderful? And they were already they were already doing that in Charleston, South Carolina, where we were for the fifth anniversary, I guess they were calling it, Charleston Food and Wine Festival. Always a splendid event and always a beautiful city to visit. So today's program.
I would love one of those magnificent southern mansions in that section we were in for the reception.
Sure, why not?
But was it great?
Anyway, we're going to kick off the program today with a restaurant that we've owed coverage of for a decade. And we finally caught up with Frank McMahon, who's the executive chef at a restaurant that's been in Charleston for 11 years, dedicated to seafood, and just one of the most splendid places there to go.
One of my new favorites, absolutely.
Yeah. And everybody knows about it, too, because it's packed. So here's Frank McMahon from Hank's Seafood.
Frank, is it McMahon or McMahon?
It's McMahon.
You have that accent.
M-A-H-O-N. Yeah, with a wee bit of a head cold, I might add.
Well, anyhow, we just were delighted to meet you. And you are, of course, the executive chef of Hank's Seafood Restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina. And we've known of it for years and never got around to going. And then we finally did.
One of the tricky things is that you're open 7 days a week, but only for dinner.
That's right.
I think we walked by one afternoon around 4 o'clock and there were people present, but that was only because they were getting ready for the evening rush.
Yeah.
And it's quite a rush now. How many dinners a night do you do again?
If you average it out, we opened up the restaurant in 99, and ever since we've been averaging about 350 covers a night, which is astounding, really.
It is.
That's the average. It can vary throughout the season, but if you average it out throughout the year, it's 350 dinners each night, and that's enough plates. We don't need to open for lunch.
Right, I guess. Frank, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I am the son of chefs. My mother was a chef. My father was a chef.
I grew up
in Ireland. My mother's Austrian. My dad's Irish. And I worked in the hotel business all the way through from a teenager on, you know, making Melba toast, chopping parsley, getting Dover sole, and it's just, I naturally fell into it from having grown up in the restaurant.
And you have it in your genes.
Exactly. And then I worked in Ireland at a number of hotels and restaurants. I did some hotel management for a while and finally found that the kitchen was the right mix for me. I got the opportunity to move to the States in 85, and then I worked at numerous restaurants in Connecticut and attended the CIA, the Culinary Institute of New York, after an externship in Germany, coming back to the States, did a stint in New York City for a few years.
You really moved around, huh?
Yeah, Los Angeles for a couple of years as well, and I've been here in Charleston since 94, and this is home.
And you worked at some interesting places in New York, huh?
Yeah, I was at the. I was very fortunate to have spent a couple of years under Eric Repair and Gilbert Lacoz at Le Bernardin.
Oh wow!
I was there.
So you knew Gilbert, huh?
I did. Yes, he was a character. He was a character. We sorely miss him.
Now, what was the opportunity that brought you here in 1985? Visas to enter the United States are not the easiest thing in the world to get.
No, I can remember trying to get my... It was supposedly a vacation visa. We all know how that goes.
you're like Daniel... Did you meet Daniel Ballou when he was in town?
I didn't get a chance to meet him, but he was a regular at Le Bernardin. All those chefs used to come in on Saturdays sometimes for lunch. They'd dine at each other's spots.
Well, he came in, I think, on a two-week visitor visa and just never left.
Well, that's basically what I did. I thought it might be. Yeah, I was in Dublin, and I remember the guy asked me, said, are you planning to work? And I said, oh, no, I'm tired of working. I need a break. Of course, that's my whole aim, was to come over here and get employment. And I got the opportunity to come to the States by working for a hotelier in Ireland who had some connections in Connecticut. And my first stint was at the Stamford Yacht Club in Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's a bit of a reason behind the name, Hanks. I think, quite honestly, you should tell Mr. Holliday it's way past time to call it Frank's.
just a few amendments in the letters could make it happen, right?
But there is a reason behind it.
No, well, Hank Holliday, actually, he's a local Charlestonian. He had the vision to open up a seafood restaurant. There was an old restaurant called Henry's back in the day, which was the quintessential Charleston seafood restaurant that had closed, and there was a niche in the market missing, and Hank wanted to recreate that in a modern version, and we opened up Hank's in 99.
Now, it wouldn't be a coincidence that it's just across the street from the Embassy Suites, which Hank owns, and also the Planters Inn, which he owns as well.
Well, it's actually the Doubletree Hotel.
Oh, the Doubletree.
It's the Doubletree, yeah. The Embassy Suites is where the festival was.
Oh, my mistake, yes.
No problem. The Doubletree, and yes, the Planters Inn, which is very nice because it feeds us definitely a lot of covers each night. We get a lot of business from the two hotels right there in the corner.
Now, you're doing traditional Charleston seafood, but in an unusual way, as Anne suggested earlier. So guide us through the menu. We have a copy of it in front of us, and of course we sampled a few things. But
I'll give you a little history. I think I told you the other night, Peter, when we sat down. Initially, when Hank wanted to open up a seafood restaurant, he asked me to come up with a menu design, and I came up with what I thought was, you know, a seafood restaurant. I'd come from La Bernardin, I'd worked in Los Angeles, and I didn't really know the local market as well as I should have, and thought I was crazy with the stuff I'd come up with. You know, it was a lot of modern contemporary stuff, a lot of carpaccios, tartars, this and that, and we both sat down and we had a chat, and he said, Frank, remember where you are. He said, you're in Charleston, South Carolina. We have to have local, indigenous specialties. We have to have good fried seafood. But he said, at the same time, we can still do the modern contemporary flair. And I think that, in a nutshell, has been the success and the cornerstone of Hank's continued success is got a menu that offers something for everybody. You can walk in here, you know, you can get a bowl of she crab soup, which is traditional. You can get a shrimp curry, a shrimp and grits, a bouillabaisse, a good fried seafood platter, a rare seared tuna with black olive vinaigrette.
Now, that was a delight.
That's right. You sampled that the other night.
Yes.
And then, you know, you go back to the fried oysters. You both had requested fried oysters.
Oh, did I love those fried oysters.
And we paired it with a roasted corn and green tomato vinaigrette with blue cheese.
That is a combination I've never seen anywhere else.
Right. And it's just, you know, we've got enough freedom. The menu is, we tweak the menu every year, and we've got chances to upgrade it and make little tweaks here and there, but core of the menu stays the same. But it's those little nuances, those little changes that keeps us current. And it doesn't go noticed or unnoticed, if you will.
Yes.
And of course, if you're a total traditionalist, you can go right down the middle of the menu
and say,
I'll have a number one, a number two, a number three, or
That's
a number
right.
four seafood platter. Thank you very much.
That's right. And then you can ask the waiter. The waiters will do a really good job of highlighting the dishes that are more driven by the cooks and myself and the creative specials we do every night.
Yeah, and your sommelier is really good at the pairings.
Yeah, Joey Ryan does a great job. We have so much fun. We've got a lot of guests, actually, a lot of locals that come in now, and they'll ask if we can do a special menu for them, you know, nothing to do with what we do here at Hank's, and can we pair some wine, and it gives us a chance to be a little bit more creative. And out of that, we generate specials and different ideas, and it keeps everyone fresh.
And you're right up there in terms of sustainability of seafood, right?
Oh, yeah, we're definitely a partner of the local Sustainable Seafood Initiative, trying to make sure that everything we serve is within the boundaries. Anything local that we can get throughout the year, we try to get. Right now, stone crabs should come available. We're looking forward to the season of soft-shell crab.
Grouper,
they've closed down for a while, but now Vermilion Snapper is going to be available. So it always changes.
Now, we met a character that you told us about as we were chatting in the while we were having dinner in the restaurant. You talked to us about Clamor Dave, and Clamor Dave was sitting at the bar.
That's right. That's right. It's funny because we were talking about him, and Clamor Dave runs his operation off one of those like river barges out on Capers Island off the Isle of Palms Marina. And he's out there, you know, day and night, and he'll call me. He says, I'm running late. I'm picking the last few oysters. And he's literally picking them out of the water as we speak. And he always shows up right in the middle of service, and he'll give you a wave. I'm here. And You saw that yourself. And yes, he ended up going out to the bar and having a couple of drinks. Well deserved, I'm sure.
Now, they're the funniest looking oysters, because they're very long and narrow.
They are long and narrow. They can be somewhat of a problem to open if you don't have the right technique, because if you use the fulcrum method and you pop it, the shell can crack in the middle sometimes.
Oh.
So it's a little tricky to get them open, but once you master the technique, the delight that awaits you, as you well know, is quite delicious.
We really enjoyed the raw oysters, but I could have dreams about your fried oysters. They were just so wonderful. I wish I had some right now.
the thing that we most amazed us, not that the most amazing thing was seeing so many people with such happy, smiling faces enjoying the food.
Yeah.
But we talked to you about the bouillabaisse, and we said, now, Frank, this traditionally comes from Marseille.
That's correct.
So there must be pastis in it, and you said, no, there isn't.
Right. Well, I mean, the different versions, if you look back, I don't think I found that many genuine recipes where they alter the flavor with Ricard or Pernod or pastis.
I could understand. I mean, I could taste the fennel in this.
Yeah. Well, that was it. That's where it comes from. You know, there's tarragon, there's fennel seed, fennel, garlic, tomato, saffron, and it's a blend of these herbs and spices to give the broth. You have to establish the broth first. So that's establish a really good broth and then use that broth to simmer the seafood into it. So the broth and the simmered seafood together and then topped with the roux just makes it top-notch.
Peter said it was the deepest in flavor broth he'd ever had.
Yeah, at least in 3 or 4 decades.
Yeah, well, incidentally, we had featured bouillabaisse at the opening night of the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, and we got so much positive feedback from it. For that night, I decided to do the roux. Initially, we didn't do it. On the menu now, we don't have the Low Country bouillabaisse. We don't normally feature the roux because we didn't know whether people would, their flavor, their profile, they'd like that.
Ah.
But we got such great feedback from the opening night from people that we made roux for that weekend, and we did a test on it, and you were part of the guinea pig test, and we obviously worked. So we're going to continue to serve the roux with the bouillabaisse. So it'll be even more traditional.
Now, there was an really interesting thing in the dish. I haven't seen a clam that size for a couple of decades either now. Does Clamor Dave produce those too?
He does. He does. Those, the little neck clams, they're beautiful. They're pristine, unbelievable.
But the size, I mean, you see clams all over Europe, and the clams you see over Europe are like about a quarter of an inch or half an inch long, and that's all. Mm-hmm. And it's more worth to open them than it is to actually eat them.
Yeah, we actually pre-steam those. You almost have to. You pre-steam them, then you keep them in the broth, you cool them down, and then we just add them to the broth at the last minute.
That's because they're so substantial.
Yeah, they are. I think for the normal portion, we actually serve 3 of those, believe it or not.
Frank, are you ever, with this all the cooking, of course, in Ireland, although they're going through some economic downturn at the moment, it just got to a fantastic high in world status as a cuisine, the new Irish cooking.
Yeah, I would agree there. You know, a lot of times when you say you're from Ireland and people...
Potatoes,
back in those days, they never thought of Ireland as a gastronomic powerhouse. And probably it wasn't at that point. I think Ireland always had the ingredients. I mean, if you look at the island with the sheep, lamb, beef, the seafood, bounty of stuff that we have over there.
And pristine waters.
That's exactly right.
Cleanest waters in the globe.
And I think the 50s, 60s, and 70s saw a lot of chefs train in Europe and then
back
into the 80s come back and kind of take things to a new level. There was that expertise. Proximity to France and England, they had done their European training and come back, and you know, the techniques used now. I don't think you can go anywhere in Ireland now would not have a handful of top-class restaurants in each city.
Well, were you ever tempted to go back?
I was. Numerous times in my career, I did think about going back. Obviously, when the Celtic Tiger hit there, I thought this is the right time to go, but Charleston's a hard place to leave, and I found a great home here, away from home, if you will. Charleston's home for me, and I don't think wild horses would drag me away from it now.
Oh, that's good to know.
So you're not going to change a thing? I said you're not going to change a thing. Hanks is always going to be Hanks?
Hanks is going to be Hanks. We will continue to evolve. We will continue to tweak. But the essence of Hanks will remain the same. It'll be a classic seafood brasserie for many more years to come, I hope.
Well, I would highly recommend it to all all of our listeners, and I'm sorry it took us so long to get there.
And make a reservation and go early. There's a wonderful communal table in the center, which you don't take reservations for. It's just a highlight, and I'm so glad we caught up with it. And
I'm glad you came. We missed you last time you were in.
Yeah, I know.
Unfortunately, we couldn't make it happen, so I'm glad it was a perfect time with the Food and Wine Festival to meet you there at the village and then to have you come in and enjoy the experience of Hank's like you did on that Saturday night.
Well, it was all conceived, contacted, and arranged within 24 hours, thanks
That's
to Joe.
Right. We made it happen, Peter, finally.
and it was such great fun, and we'll see you next time we're in Charleston for sure.
I look forward to it, Peter and Ann. Best of luck.
Thanks,
now let's do the website.
The website.
You can go on Open Table and make reservations for Hank's, and you can go to our website, which is www.hanksseafoodrestaurant.com.
That's all there is to it.
We better let you go to work. You got another 350
That's
companies
right,
headed
Dad,
your way.
Pots are boiling as we speak.
Good talking to you, Frank.
Good talking to you guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig, our weekly internet connection to you. And stay in touch with every means you want, email, Facebook, and this arriving, and Twitter, of course. That's arriving on everybody's email now to me. You know, everybody's got a space on Facebook and on Twitter. And
I'm probably the only one in the whole universe who doesn't.
Right.
But that's okay, because I got plenty of other things to do with my time.
Well, this is an issue.
Anyway,
next up, we're going to contrast old and new.
Well, we're going to first of all...
New and old, actually.
We're actually going to thank two very special friends who always tell us the right places to go in Charleston. Otherwise, we wouldn't finish up there. So, Mickey Baxt. The August general manager of the Charleston Grill at Charleston Place Hotel always knows the hottest place in town. So we asked him, and he said, Amen Restaurant is the place you have to go.
Amen Street,
I beg your pardon. So we went to Amen Street, of course, and we managed to connect up with Todd Garrigan, who's the executive chef there at very short notice, and almost even shorter notice because we asked Frank Lee, who's the executive chef at slightly north of Broad, and one of our favorite Charlestonians. And he introduced Anne to the owner of a restaurant called 82 Queen. And Frank said, this man knows more about the Charleston restaurant scene than anybody I know. Introduced him to Anne, and we followed up on that. So we had the opportunity to catch up with him, too. And it turns out that he's from the Pittsburgh area, which makes it just that much more fascinating. So contrasting, then, the newest first, and then one of the oldest restaurants in Charleston, I think you'll enjoy listening to both.
Well, we rarely ever ignore recommendation by our good friend Mickey from Charleston Grill. So we find ourselves, not too surprisingly, at Amen Street, a recent arrival on the Charleston, South Carolina restaurant seat, talking to the chef, Todd Garrigan, a nice Irishman with a big smile and smiling eyes. Good to meet you, Todd.
Likewise.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit. You, first of all, were born in Memphis, Tennessee. You started your training in Atlanta. You worked in Washington, D.C., and you had relatives here in Charleston, and so you meandered into this realm, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And my question, you grew up in Texas. I forgot that part. And my question was, what kind of barbecue would you do with that kind of background? Because that's a very serious issue.
Right. Well, it's licensed to have a healthy mix, so you can take the best of everybody's and put it together.
Well, now, this restaurant, as I said, we didn't know about it before. It's charming. It's comfy rustic. Is that how you'd describe the
decor? Yeah, I think so. I think the idea was to have the feel of maybe early 50s San Francisco bar, a big bar with lots of natural wood. And it really just kind of It's a little bit minimalist, with the exception of the oyster shell chandeliers.
Oh, is that what they are? Because they're gorgeous. They're absolutely stunning. I wonder if I could make one of those.
Yeah, it took me a long time to eat all those oysters.
Oh, I'll bet so. Which brings us to the subject of, what is the culinary style? What cuisine do you have offer at Amen Street?
Well, we're about 99% fresh seafood. Most of the stuff is pretty simple. Not a lot of hot sauces and stocks and reductions. We only make a crab stock for our she crab soup, and other than that, everything is cold, a lot of citrus, and no, we're trying to let the fish be the star here.
Sounds good. Now, you also, we were talking a little bit before, you adhere to the sustainability, seafood sustainability, well, what do you call it?
The Sustainable Seafood Initiative. We definitely adhere to that. It's really important for the environment, but it's particularly in this city, and if you're going to serve as much fish as we do, you have to adhere to their guidelines, because otherwise you're doing yourself a disservice and the people around you. But it's a small part of going green, I guess you could say, but it supports domestic and local fishermen and the local shrimp industry.
Do you think that this is an issue that's been exaggerated, or do you think it's a real issue?
I think that it's important that you know where you're sourcing your products from. I if you see a species go away, it's not coming back. I think that as long as you're buying domestic, we have really strict regulations. But by getting to hunt for maybe a little lesser known fish instead of just always serving the same three or four that everyone serves, you really open the menu up. And you open your diners up to a lot new stuff they might not get. A lot of things that were trash fish, they would call them before, are highlights of people's menus now.
Now give me some examples.
Well, I think that probably the hottest fish that you can get right now is a trigger fish, and it's
trigger.
Yeah, it's probably the best eat that there is. It's a nice thin fillet. It's got a really good amount of oil in it. The flakes come off real nice. I mean, it's really terrific. We can't keep it in. If we get 10 or 20 pounds of it, it's gone in a day.
Wow. Now, you change your menu all the time, right?
Yeah, we have our about 30 items that are always on the menu, and that's all day long, lunch and dinner. A lot of focus on appetizers and things like that, because we have such a big bar. And then the other side of the menu...
And a busy bar, I might add. Everybody seems to be having a good time.
Well, it's happy hour right now. So.
Oh, I see. Okay.
it's only 5 p.m. How can it be happy hour already?
Oh, I think doesn't happy hour start at 4?
Well, it did, because we came into the restaurant about 4:30.
Yeah, in Carolina, happy hour starts at 4.
Everybody was already happy.
Well, we feature our fresh oysters and our fresh fish. And then our daily specials could be anywhere between 3 and 5 or 6 items, depending on how adventurous we're going to be that day. You know, oysters come from up and down the East Coast and the West Coast. This time of year, there's a lot of focus on the local ones. We get them from Bluffton and we get them from McClellanville. I don't have any of them on tonight, but tomorrow we'll have some back. But they go so the price is better, and they go really, really fast because everyone likes to eat local.
I remember when... Nothing seemed to be. It used to be all kind of big continental style stuff, and nothing was local. Now, you have wonderful products in this area.
Right. Well, there's a ton of agriculture in South Carolina. It's a very rural state, but we're lucky, with the wetlands and everything around here. We have that Johns Island can supply you with tons and tons of good produce, and then the ocean is our backyard. So, you'd be silly not to be buying stuff from that guy. I mean, I don't want to buy something that got caught in Charleston and, trucked to Charlotte and then buy it from Charlotte,
Yeah, right.
So it just makes sense.
So do people come knocking on your back door or what?
We started out only using one purveyor, and they're a local guy, but they're a little bit bigger fish house. And as we've gone on, we've started to source particular items from different people. We bring all of our tuna in from Hawaii, which isn't very local, but they have it can't be touched, the quality, I don't think. We have a local clam guy, a couple local oyster guys, and then a couple of boats that they catch specific
shrimpers.
Items. Yeah, the shrimp. Yeah, shrimp. Most of the shrimp that we buy come from Georgetown, which is just right up the road.
Could you pick a few items on this menu that you could explain so people have an idea of what they're getting when they come here?
Sure. Well, we do, under our starter section, we have a few fried items. Everybody orders shrimp corn dogs.
That's oh, no.
everyone who comes here orders them, and they're...
You're a signature.
Yeah, yes. It's a cool dish. You get 4 little local shrimp that are fried in a corn dog batter with a fairly interesting presentation.
Oh, really?
We sell a lot of the fried squid, and we sell a ton of soup. My favorite items all fall under the raw bar and chilled seafood cocktails with scallops, crudo. So crudo is Italian for raw.
Crudo.
Yeah,
that's
we do
great.
We do a crudo, a tartare, and a ceviche that are staples on the menu, and those all do pretty well. I think the warmer it gets, the more we'll sell of those.
Yeah, that's we're my still, kind of
it's
stuff.
It's been pretty cold, so you catch a lot of soup and comfort food right now. So, but and then we'll. Whatever we, if we get something that's just unbelievably fresh or new, we'll do a ceviche or a crudo or something with it that night for on the first day we have it, just to show it off if it's just really unbelievable. And then after that, we'll turn it in, we'll put it on the catch board and cook it.
How about some specifics? How hard is it to get a reservation? And do you need a reservation?
We actually are so small, we only take reservations for seven or more. We found out that we could feed more people by doing it that way. So if you're two or four, just come on in.
Uh-huh.
You know, we got a really big bar, so there's plenty of space to wait around, and the wait's never really that long. Surprisingly, for the quality of food we're putting out, we can put it out pretty fast.
And what, where are you located? And it's very central, isn't it?
Yeah, it's on East Bay Street, which is all the way downtown Charleston. It's kind of Restaurant Row down here now. You know, 15 years ago, there was one restaurant, and now there's probably 12 within.
Now, be careful, listeners, not to ask for Amen Street, because Amen Street doesn't exist anymore. It's called Cumberland.
Right, Cumberland and East Bay. Amen Street was an old alley in the 1700s that used to run from Church Street to East Bay. They said they called it Amen Street because you could hear the amens coming from the big churches, which are right down the street. And I believe another story is that it was you were supposed to say your amens because it was the last street before the wall.
Oh,
so you that's where they gave out the lashings.
There you go. So if you're coming here, let's suppose you're coming from Market Street or from King Street, you just walk east on Market Street or Cumberland. If you're on Cumberland, you get to East Bay. It's right there.
Right. It's on the corner, and if you look in the window, you'll know where you are.
And listeners, here's the man who's raising his kids right. His children eat sweetbreads, and they're how old?
4 and 6, but that... They'd probably be a little bit more picky now. She was only 2 when she ate those, and so, you know, when they're 2, they'll eat whatever you put in front of them.
And then they change every week. They change,
right?
I know.
No more vegetables.
Yeah. How about a website?
AmenStreet.com.
That should be easy enough.
Oh yeah.
Is there anything else anybody should know about this place?
Well, if you want to look, you can get all the information about the place and see all the reviews if you follow us on Facebook as well. We have a page on Facebook, so that'll give you links to Amen Street Fish and Raw Bar. Yeah, that'll give you all the links to the great press that we've gotten so far. It's been fantastic.
This place is buzz, listeners.
Well, I guess the city has been looking for, it's really kind of a bistro. We're serving fresh fish and seafood, but in a really more of a bistro atmosphere. So there's some smaller plates. We do a fried seafood platter. They say it's the best in the city, but that's not what we're hanging our hat on. You know, we're like the fried seafood.
They say is
the best around, but we're not hanging our hat on that. But if we're going to be as good as we want to be, we should have the best fried seafood plate, right? So.
Well, it's really an exciting place, and it was a real thrill to meet you. I thought we knew everybody in the city, but we didn't. And now I'm happy to have you in our association of friends as well.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes.
I'll have to thank Mickey as well. That was
Mickey's wonderful. Thank you, Mickey. We'll be seeing Mickey later this evening, so we'll let him know that you'll be talking to him about it. And
absolutely.
Todd, we're so delighted we were able to put this together, especially since we only called you about 4 hours ago.
Well, you know, in this profession, you got to be pretty flexible. So.
And you are. All right. So here we go, and good luck to you. And again, thank you
very much.
Well, On the Menu has to come a long way to find another native Pittsburgher in the food business. And here we are with Stephen Kish, who's proprietor and CEO of 82 Queen, a very well-established, long-running restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Ann.
You love it here, you said.
I do. I moved down here 30 years ago, and I don't regret it.
Yeah, it was your wife was native, though.
My wife and her family are from here. They're from the Johns Island area in the West Ashley area of Charleston.
And you said since her grandfather was born here, you're accepted after 30 years.
That's right. Her parents are all born here, and so I'm a Charlestonian, and my kids are Charlestonians.
And now you have a very popular restaurant here, but you've watched the restaurant scene develop and change over 30 years. What can you tell it? What was it like when you arrived here 30 years ago, and what are the changes you've observed up until now, 2010?
I mean, 30 years ago, there were not a whole lot of white tablecloth restaurants in town. We were probably one of five when we opened up the restaurant. The streets of Charleston did not look like they do today. There were a lot of warehouses, a lot of empty buildings. It was a little rougher area back then, the downtown area. It has come a long way in 30 years. And 30 years is not a long time in the restaurant business.
Oh, and yeah.
We have over 150 restaurants in downtown Charleston now. And we have some of the finest restaurants in the world in Charleston. And people just come here, tourists come here for that reason, just to visit the restaurants here.
Well, no, I mean, it's not just that people just kept cooking low country cuisine. There have been changes in the offerings of the restaurants, right?
Right. I mean, we're kind of known for our low country cuisine, but we change our menu every 6 months and try to keep up. But there's so many other different styles of cooking in Charleston. All kind of unique things that people do, like McCrady's and Sean Brock down there, and the Magnolias Group and High Cotton Group, and they've really stepped it up. And a lot of young chefs just moving up.
And Asian food, I mean, this is whole new to me.
A lot of different Asian food, but a lot of white tablecloths still try to have a little flair for the South, and they still want new South cooking with the way they do the grits and pastas and using all the local seafoods. And farm-to-plate is real big in Charleston. All the local-grown produce and local, raised cattle and seafood. The seafood is very abundant in Charleston.
Now, were you doing that when you came?
Yeah, I mean, 82 Queen, I'll tell you, in 1982, 82 Queen, I was a chef at the beginning. I was a chef, and I was a chef for many years, still about 6 years ago. I just kind of hung up the knives, just kind of got tired of being in the kitchen. But we've always used fresh seafood. We've always used fresh beef. We've always used the fresh vegetables here. We're back in the 80s. We're the trendsetters and not using frozen products and making everything from scratch.
Now, you were telling me, I mean, you really trained with the best, the biggest and brightest.
Well, back when I was in school, Ferdinand Metz was my teacher. Ed Brown, who ran the American Culinary Federation for years, executive director, chefs like Jack Braun.
Oh, Jack died recently.
I can't answer that.
I can't remember.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, his restaurant's gone. I knew
right,
that.
The restaurant's gone.
Jack, we hope not. And
if you're listening, I'm sorry.
If you are, no, we're sure you're watching us down here, watching a pupil who's been very successful.
Oh, yes.
And people who come here, who comes here? You get the tourists, you get the
it's a mixture of tourists and locals, and of course when the tourist season comes, which starts very soon, it starts by the middle of March, the tourists start hitting town, and every restaurant downtown will see the tourists, and we see an influx of business come in every spring, and it's great for the city because we've got so many places to go.
Taxi driver said when he moved here, and I can't remember how many years ago, it was early 70s, I think he said, there weren't. You didn't have all these tourists.
Oh no, the tourists.
It's a whole different city, he said.
Oh, it is. It's the city has done a very good job cleaning up the city and putting in some nice parks and redoing all the roadways and streets, and just the city's just a lot cleaner place. And then of course you got all the old homes south abroad, and that really brings the people in every spring. They have a tour of homes every spring.
Aren't they gorgeous? Wouldn't I love to have one of those?
Oh yes.
Do you live there?
I walk down there sometimes, and is it the Calhoun Mansion that's the biggest
Calhoun
one?
Calhoun Mansion is the big one down there. Of course, everything on the Battery down there is huge houses down there.
What do those houses cost?
I mean, I think, years ago they went for $1 million or so, and now they go anywhere from $5 to $10 million, I think, in that range. I mean,
if they ever come in the market, huh?
That's right. You just gotta find the right buyer.
You gotta find the right seller to get on their list to buy.
That's true too.
Now, this restaurant is itself an intriguing assemblage of buildings.
This restaurant consists of three buildings. When we back in '82, it was two buildings, and we purchased a third one a couple years after that. It's unique. It's the front bar building we're sitting in right now is a carriage house. And the large windows and doors you see on both sides, because the horses came in with the carriages, and they would go out in the courtyard, turn the horse around, and turn the carriage around, and park it in this carriage house. And upstairs was the servants' quarters, upstairs. And in the back was the main house for the folks who owned the building.
But you said you use the main house for the kitchen now.
The downstairs part of it is our kitchen facility, but upstairs is still dining.
I see.
And we got nine different dining rooms. We've got 220 seats here in nice weather. Of course, we've got 70 of our seats outside in the courtyard. So we like nice sunny days.
Yeah, who cooks?
I've got a very good chef. His name's Brad Jones. He's been with me about 9 years. He's a graduate of the Trident Culinary Arts in Charleston, and he does a very good job for us.
What's the hottest thing on your menu today?
I tell you, we've had things on our menus. We got some old staples in Charleston, like the shrimp and grits and the crab cakes and the jambalayas and gumbos and creoles. And we really can't take them off the menu. If you take them off the menu, our customers will get mad at us. But besides that, we use fresh fish. Every day we buy one or two different kind of fresh fish. It changes daily. And we try to buy the best beef we can.
Oh, you have beef, too?
We do have. Which you have to have a little bit of everything in the restaurant business. So we have beef, pork, chicken, but lots of seafood, seafood-oriented. We probably sell more shrimp and grits and crab cakes than anybody in the city.
Now, you're very fortunate with the climate in South Carolina, also that you have a wide range of vegetables all year round.
We do. I mean, they're starting to plant tomatoes right now. We get a lot of our produce from a place called Boone Hall Farms. And Boone Hall is right up 17 north from us, about 8 miles up 17. And it's connected with Boone Hall Plantation. And the owner out there is a very good friend of mine, and we have first pick of the produce out there.
Well, you better grow your tomatoes because Florida got
hit. Yeah, Florida just got hit.
I mean, the price of tomatoes is supposedly.
Right. I mean, our tomatoes here go in the ground in about a week or two is what the farmers tell me. They'll be planted, you know, from small plants in a week or two.
Now you still have fried green tomatoes on your menu already.
Every day.
They're being snuck in from outside.
A lot of them from Mexico, a lot of them from Florida. But fried green tomatoes are such a staple in Charleston that the produce guys, you know, find a way to get them.
You also have this cookbook, which you say you're about to revise, right?
Right, and this is a cookbook you got in front of you. It's got about 175 recipes, all of them, you know, recipes from A to Queen. There's even a wine and food pairing section in there, a chapter in there, you know, food and wine pairing. And it's been a very popular book. We've sold, you know, lots of them over the years.
Called Low Country Cooking with 82 Queen.
That's right.
Featuring the perfect pair. The website is www.A2Queen.com, and this is open how many days of the week?
We're open 7 days a week. We're open for lunch and dinner. We've got a Sunday brunch on Sundays. Like I said, it's been around a long time. We've got a lot of people that have been coming for 28 years. We've got some people that get, you know, been married here, got engaged here, and they bring their kids back, and their kids get engaged here.
Right. And how do you find this Charleston Wine and Food Festival?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing for the city. There's a lot of activities going on for the last 3 days. I've been a part of some of myself. It's just great for the city.
Yeah, it's the fifth anniversary.
Fifth year, and gets bigger every year.
Every year, because we were here year number two. This is like
right, and they seem to hit it just right. The weather is just right. A little bit crisp in the mornings, but the sun comes up in the afternoon. Like today, it'll be 60. Tomorrow, it'll be 70 degrees. And so the weather's just right.
Well, it's better than the city you left 13 years ago.
I understand that.
There's 4 feet of snow on the ground.
I talked to my family up there, and they're, you know, at least 2 feet of snow on the ground right now.
Okay. Now, you're giving something back to the community as well, because I think you said you're president of the Charleston
Right, I was current
Restaurant
president of the Restaurant
Association.
I'm on the Board of Governors with the Charleston Visitors Bureau. I've been giving back to the community all my life.
What do you see coming? Is there something new that you can project, or is Charleston just going to be the Charleston we know today?
I hope it stays the way it is today for a while. There's a lot of fine food here. It's hard to make it any better.
Let me put you on the spot. Aside from 82 Queen,
uh-huh.
Where are your favorites when you're on a night off?
That's a spot there. You put me on the spot for sure there.
Well, of course.
There are so many good restaurants. A lot of them, of course, on East Bay Street, kind of like Restaurant Row of the city. I got a lot of good friends all over the city. It's hard for me even to say one restaurant, but I know everybody in the city.
We'll let you have two or three.
Okay, thank you. I mean, it'd definitely be like High Cotton and Snobs and the Magnolias Group. And, okay. Of course, I can't leave Brett out or Cypress out.
Okay. Now, they've all been... They have multiplied themselves.
They
Cook
have.
Carolina they have. And Maverick Group. Why didn't you do that?
Back in the late 80s, we had four restaurants going at one time. And Hugo came through town. Everybody remembers Hurricane Hugo.
Okay, yes.
And that was a rough time for Charleston back in the late 80s and early 90s.
Right.
And it was hard to keep them all going. So at that time, we kind of pulled back and just came back to the mothership and just... took care of the mothership. Not saying we won't expand in the future. I'm still young enough to get out there and do another
Maverick,
one.
Look out, Maverick, Southern Kitchens. Here comes...
That's right.
Stephen Kish.
I suspect there's a hint of an expansion future possibly, huh?
There's always that chance.
Well, Stephen, this has been wonderful for you to receive us here and give us the tour. And it's just a lovely property. And it's good sitting, even though it's cool out, it's great sitting under those wonderful high-powered heaters you've got.
And watch this. Ever the geographer, because we started walking at number 1 Queen Street, and it's a long way
from East Bay Street
to number 82, because number 82 is almost at the corner of King Street.
Right, we're right at the corner of King and Queen.
And just a few blocks south of Market Street.
That's correct.
So if you're on your way to the wonderful mansions that line King Street towards the Battery, it's a good place to stop on the way there. It's also a fabulous place to stop on the way back.
That's right. And it's a unique place. It's a very old. It's 150 years of history here. 150 years. These buildings are 150 years old, and it's just a unique place to come see. It's not something you can just, an architect can't just build this. It's something you have to create.
Yeah. Thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome. I hope your stay in Charleston is very well, and the rest
of the
Food and Wine Festival is good to you.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You're welcome.
Bye. It's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You, of course, are listening to Ann and Peter Haig at On the Menu Radio, and one of the most fun things that happens in these food and wine conferences that we go to is the people that we meet. Sometimes new friends, sometimes old friends. And the final segment of the program is a combination of that. First of all, Holly Herrick, who just completed a book all about the food of the Charleston restaurants and essentially sort of reviews of them too, because she, I think, still is the fine dining critic for the Charleston Intelligencer or whatever the newspaper there is called, but she put a lot of work into creating a combination of cookbook and a restaurant guide for Charleston, and we had the chance to catch up with her to talk about that. And then three old friends are on the menu. First of all, Chris Hastings from the Hot and Hot Fish Club in Birmingham, Alabama, who's
these
been on the
program.
Yeah, he's been on the program before talking about his cookbook, and once again, he was insistent that we visit them in Birmingham, Alabama. So Birmingham, Alabama is coming up real soon.
I never thought I'd ever be in Birmingham, Alabama.
Farmer Lee Jones.
From
Huron, Ohio, or wherever it is, whose property was covered in snow, he told us, but he still had vegetables for the event. And he was attending a very special event, a diversity dinner, and he explains why. And then, not to be outdone, James Peterson, author of now going on 15 wonderful cookbooks.
Amazing.
And we had the opportunity to meet him in person, which was really a whole lot of fun.
Especially since he was so tall.
He was tall too.
I never knew he was that tall.
We never knew anything about him. We'd only seen his picture in his book. We had the opportunity to meet him in person, and that was fun too. So he is a group of new and old friends.
Holly Herrick, this is not your first cookbook you produced, but it certainly garnered an awful lot of attention. It's called The Charleston Chef's Table. And congratulations. Everybody's very excited about this book.
Thank you so much.
It's not like you didn't have a lot of information, a lot of content to work with. What was the motivation for you writing this book?
Well, I think that I love Charleston, and I know Charleston.
Are you a native?
No, I'm not, and I guess I never will be because I wasn't born here and my grandfather wasn't born here.
This is true.
But I have lived here for 10 years, just over 10 years. And I love the city hugely for its history, but probably most for its food. And I contend in the book and on a regular basis that we live in one of the best food towns in the country, and definitely in the South.
And you were trained as a chef.
I did. I trained as a chef at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris, and my grand diploma in pastry and cuisine. And the reason I went there was because I have a journalism background. I always wanted to be a journalist, but my life kind of got moved around. But anyway, Julia Child herself told me to go there because I wanted to get my food writing credentials. But as far as why...
You knew Julia.
I met Julia at a food and wine festival, in fact, in Aspen. And she said, I asked her, quickly and quite generously gave her time. How do I, what do I do to become a food writer, not just a journalist? And she said, can you get to the Cordon Bleu? And fortunately, I was in a time in my life when I could, and it was wonderful. But
you could have been Meryl Streep.
Well, yeah, no. She did a fabulous job. That was a great movie. But the truth is, the fodder for this book really came from my work as a restaurant critic for the Post and Courier. And I've eaten at many times virtually every restaurant in the greater Charleston area. And not all of them good, but most of them fabulous. And I hate the thought of people coming to this beautiful town and missing out on the real deal, whether it be the food or the real essence of what Charleston is about, its personality, its essence, its beauty. So
there are a lot of tourist traps.
There are, and I cannot stand it when I see people going in them. Because
you can't tell us what they are.
No. They have a purpose.
I wish you could. It would really help people.
Oh, I might die tomorrow.
you might be assassinated tomorrow.
It's true. It's competitive here. But Charleston has really evolved in the past 10 years since I came here. Just better and better restaurants. A much broader diversity in terms of the types of restaurants that we have. And just the bar just is higher and higher. I mean, the stuff of Sean Brock's McCrady's or Mike Lotta's Fig or Robert Stelling's Hominy Grill. I mean, it's just a reason to be.
What was the last one?
Hominy Grill. Hominy Grill. Right, you cannot come to the town without going there.
I know we've been.
Yeah, but what's fabulous is there's so much delicious food, but at all price points. It's just you can't walk two blocks in this, especially in this part of town, without walking by an exceptional restaurant.
Well, to explain what this book is. I mean,
it's really
you go
three.
Through all of these restaurants and chefs.
Yeah, it's really kind of three things. First off, it's a cookbook, and I'll come back to that part. But it's also essentially a restaurant guide. And it's a coffee table cookbook because you see there's gorgeous photography of the city. But as far as what I did was I picked, I believe we're close to 70 restaurants, and they were only included if I think they're good. And I am a tough cookie, let me tell you.
You are a tough cookie.
I am. I used to have some real mean letters written about me to the Post and Courier from restaurants that didn't like what I had to say. But I mean that. I do that I feel that I want people to know the truth about a restaurant being good. So anyway, they're excellent restaurants. They're all over the town, all over the city, from not just downtown. And I picked recipes from each restaurant that were really representative of the style of the restaurant. In some cases, it was kind of a signature dish. In other cases, like, for example, Mike Lott is famous for using local produce, so I wanted to use him in the salad. I love Michael, and I love Fig, and I don't think the acronym should stand for food is good. I think it should be food is great.
Right, yeah, I would do good.
He's an awesome chef. Yeah. Just one example of many.
I have a funny question I'm going to ask. This is true of any restaurant guidebook, and one that's like everything's accelerated, particularly in Charleston, too. How do you keep updating this? Because the restaurants, by the time this is published, had any of them gone out of business yet?
Well, yes, and it is a challenge, especially for someone who's used to a much shorter print, once you write at print time, like, you know, a few days as opposed to a year. But what I did, two have closed. Amuse has closed, and Raval has closed. The same, in that case, it's not really a sad story. The same owners just kind of changed the name of the restaurant and the image.
So you will routinely just reissue updates of this?
Yes. For the cookbook itself, though, it will be, well, it's in the contract anyway. We haven't started it yet because it'd be a little soon, but there will be revisions over the years that I will do. But I personally stay current by going out to all the restaurants every week, and I kind of basically blog about that. So it serves as kind of a way for me to document it.
So you're a blogger as well? Do you want to give your blog spot?
It's hollyherrick.com. HollyHerrick.com.
Right. Okay.
Now let's put you entirely on the spot.
Okay.
Number 1, 2, 3, your favorite.
You know, Peter, I get asked that question so often, and I really hate saying it because it's like everything with me. It depends on the day, what I'm in the mood for. But I think the three, and they really consistently roll off my tongue, restaurants that I, on any given day of the year, any given time of the day, that I would absolutely not miss an opportunity to go to, and are three, probably the three best in the city. And I've already mentioned, actually, I think all three of them. McCrady's, I think, is probably the most cutting edge, most magnificent restaurant we have. And Sean Brock is he's nominated for James Beard this year.
Exactly.
Let's see. Fig.
Fig is fabulous.
You know, there it is. Food is great. I mean, its ambiance isn't really fancy, but it's sophisticated and cosmopolitan. The food is the reason to go there.
Okay, I'm interested in number three, because the first two are really obvious.
Number three has got to be Hominy Grill, just because, I mean, it's I love it. I love their chocolate pudding. I love their vegetable plate. I think he just makes really, really true to the heart Southern food. And you can't resist the big nasty biscuit for breakfast.
Ah, you certainly get filled up when you come to Charleston to eat, right?
Well, Holly, thank you so much for joining us. We're sitting in a restaurant called High Cotton, which is part of the Maverick Kitchens chain. So we mustn't forget to mention Crew Carolina and Maverick Southern Kitchen and the other group.
Right.
Each of whom have three restaurants on East Bay.
Right.
So you can start on East Bay at Market Street, just keep on going south, and you'll run out of energy before you run out of places to eat, I think.
You summed it up very well. It's
yeah,
true.
And you are interacting with some of the more interesting people in the culinary world. So congratulations on all your accomplishments.
Thank you.
And how much fun you must be having.
I am having fun. It's wonderful for me to see the book out there because it lets people know how wonderful our city is. Hopefully that's the message and where the best food is.
Thanks, Holly.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you both.
On the menu is at a very special breakfast in Charleston, South Carolina. It's Saturday morning. It's only a little after 9 o'clock. But a lot of attendees of the Charleston Food and Wine Festival are already up and about. And I caught up just now with Chris Hastings.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
And Chris, remind us again where you're from.
Birmingham, Alabama, and the Hot and Hot Fish Club.
Which is a fascinating story in itself. And there's an interview back in January about the cookbook that
right.
Chris just completed about this. It tells the whole Hot and Hot Fish story. But, Chris, what brings you all the way from Birmingham to Charleston, South Carolina?
Well, I've done this event a number of years now. This is my third visit, and cooked with Mike Latta at Fig Restaurant last night and also Andrew Carmelini.
Oh, isn't Mike just the coolest guy?
Let me tell you, there's no finer chef in America than Mike Latta. He's one of the best, and I really enjoy him and his food and his team. They're tremendous.
We were so excited when he won the James Beard Award.
Well-deserved.
We have a picture of him on the website, absolutely exhilarated.
Was he in his mustache phase or his full beard stage?
He was in a mustache phase at this
yes.
time. The beard, I'll bet, is back on again.
Yes, back on.
And Andrew Carmelini was here as well?
That's right, and we had a great time with him. Conda Verde is his new restaurant. And
Conda Verde.
Conda Verde, yes.
Okay, sure. Yeah, we have to get there next time we go to New York. Now, what did you fix?
My course was wild Alabama watercress with crawfish, Iberian ham, and a preserved lemon vinaigrette.
Oh, my goodness.
Iberico ham, excuse me.
Was it the real top line with the black feet and everything?
Absolutely.
Oh, boy. That
it
must
was
have
unbelievable.
Been, that must have been smashing.
And nice flavors. You know, the spring has sprung here in the South, so crawfish are starting to come out of the mud, and the crawfish is choking the little limestone springs all around our state. And it's, you'll find shad roe and all of the harbingers of spring out there. So it's a great time of the year to be cooking, as is every time of
but
the year.
But, yeah, you do all the seasons, and your cookbook features the seasons,
that's right.
too.
So. That's what we're all about.
So you have to go, listeners. We haven't been to Birmingham, Alabama since forever. We keep on promising we're going to go and see Chris Hastings and Frank Stitt and all the rest of your cronies.
That's right. We've got a pretty good bunch of cooks hanging out in old Birmingham, Alabama. You need to come visit us, Peter. Bring your lovely wife also.
Well, I'm not allowed to go anywhere without her.
Ah, good.
Except last week I was in Atlanta because she hates Atlanta, so I was allowed to go there on my own.
Atlanta's a little crowded sometimes.
So
tough to get around.
So it's the Hot and Hot Fish Club
in
Birmingham, Alabama. And what are a couple of your featured super dishes there?
Well, seasonally, if I were to go through it, I would say the dish that we did last night at Fig is a good example of seasonality. If you roll from spring into summer, one of our probably the dish that people most identify us with is the Hot and Hot Tomato Salad. Heirloom tomatoes, sweet corn, fried okra, a little bacon, aioli, and a balsamic vinaigrette, field peas. It's a takeoff on succotash, but done, kind of deconstructed and reassembled in a manner that is not cooked. So it's a room temperature dish and just has tons of flavor and is fantastic.
And it's undoubtedly in the cookbook.
Of course. It's
so,
featured.
So it's the Hot and Hot Fish Club cookbook. You can buy it online at On the Menu Radio. You can buy it at your favorite bookstore as well. And then you can pretend you're like Chris Hastings and your lovely wife who works with you.
Yes, Idy. She's the best.
Is Idy here?
Actually, no, she's at home with our two boys, 17 and 19, and they're at home from prep school, and so she's looking after them. She misses seeing you, though. Well, she says to say hello, Peter.
Okay, well, we're going to let you have some breakfast now, Chris. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. It's been sort of cold in Charleston, South Carolina, Farmer Lee Jones. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you know, I guess that's all relative, Peter. You know, I left home in Ohio with 3 foot of snow, so...
Well, you jumped out ahead of me because on the menu's home in Pittsburgh is under 3 or 4 feet of snow as well. So the fact that the sun is shining here in Charleston, South Carolina is a bonus. But there's a reason we're here, because we're both here at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. And as always, Farmer Lee Jones is doing something interesting and different. Tell us what brings you to Charleston for the festival.
Well, I'll tell you, there's no place like home, but if I was ever going to pick a place to live, it would be Charleston, South Carolina. The folks, the hospitality, this food and wine event is truly one of the great of the year.
But you're doing a special event.
We are, and I am so deeply honored to be a part of this dinner. This is a dinner that's called a diversity dinner, and it's celebrating diversity in culinary, and it's to celebrate all of the ethnicities that really bring up cuisine, and it's just such a true honor, and we're having a wonderful dinner tonight. It's a sellout. In fact, it's been sold out for now over 2 weeks. People are clamoring for a ticket.
Yeah, I would clamor for a ticket myself if I thought there was a chance to get one. Now, what did you bring down? Did you bring down some special veggies?
Well, there is just a tremendous group of chefs that are participating in this event from all over the country. They flew chefs in. And what we did was we actually shared with each of those chefs a couple of weeks ahead of time the things that we're the most excited about coming out of the greenhouses and the cold frames and root storage right now.
Okay, so you're doing inside culture because it's too cold.
Well, we do have some greenhouse, some hothouse, cold frames, root cellar. Of course, some product that we harvested last fall and are storing in the root cellars. So there's some heirloom carrots featured tonight that are just fabulous. In fact, just like wine is actually curing, and we're finding that our flavors have gone up since we've harvested them.
That's absolutely amazing. And is that a new concept?
Well, a new old concept. We don't think we invent anything. My dad has a saying that the only thing we're trying to do is get as good as the growers were 100 years ago. and in many cases, that's true. Now, obviously, we're trying to tie technology to that today that wasn't available back then. But, if you look back 100 years, it was pre-chemical, pre-synthetic fertilizer, rebuilding nutrients naturally rather than chemically. And it's really about working in harmony with nature rather than trying to outsmart it.
And that's exactly what you're doing at your property. So give us the website before we sign off, Lee.
Well, thechefsgarden.com.
Farmer Lee Jones, always a pleasure to talk to you. I'll bet we'll see you in New York at the James Beard Awards, if not before.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be a part of your radio show here this morning.
Thank you so much, Peter. To meet you again.
My pleasure.
A funny thing happened yesterday at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. August cookbook author James Peterson taught a class. James, what happened?
Well, I was making orange tuiles, Peter, and it turned out as a disaster. I took the tuiles out of the oven, and you're supposed to let them cool a little bit. They're flat when they come out of the oven. They're on a sheet pan. They're flat, and you're supposed to curve them over a rolling pin. Well, I kept lifting them off the sheet pan. They fell apart. So it was an absolute disaster. But everybody was...
Why did you select orange tuiles?
Well, they're wonderful when they turn out. If I had made them right, they're wonderful. They're very, very thin. They're very, very delicate.
Is this a trendy item?
Well, I don't know. It could be, I guess. If I do it enough, maybe it will become one.
And what did you do then when they fell apart?
Well, I just stood there like an idiot. Fortunately, it was only a half an hour, and they gave me the hook.
It's so funny because we were going to interview James about what it's like when they let an author out of the pen. Because you've written how many books?
13.
Well, I'm working on 15.
You're working on 15, and these are not baby books. These are big books.
Well, for the most part, they are, Peter. Yes.
So
yes.
So
list some of the names of the books, because we have you. We never actually talked to you about baking, which was the latest one. But you're doing one on meat.
Well, they all have these simple titles of groups. The next one to come out is meat. And the one following that is called Simple, which is a rebellion from my usual tact, which is to do these thorough thorough books.
You did that wonderful French one, right?
The French book, that was, I think, number four.
I keep that actually in the counter in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah, do
and
you?
I'm glad. I think we talked to you about that, but we also talked to you about the baking book. That was the most recent time you were on the menu.
Yes, that was the most recent book, and that was the one for which I was doing the orange tweels.
But so now you're going to have to go back and practice.
Now I have to go back and practice the orange tweels.
And so what are some of the other titles? You had a bread?
Well, the first book was Sauces. And that was the one that won Cookbook of the Year.
That's also, I saved that for reference. It's incredibly comprehensive.
That one did very well. And then Soups, Splendid Soups was second. And then Fish and Shellfish. And Vegetables. And Essentials of Cooking. And then the French book was after that.
But you're here in Charleston. You're having a good time.
I'm having a great time. It's so nice to be away from the pen, as you describe it.
What is your background? I mean, how do you know all these things?
Well, I studied chemistry at Berkeley. That was my background. And then I dropped out of Berkeley and went around the world. I decided I wanted to travel. I went around the world. I got a job and saved money and went around the world on $5 a day. It took 6 months.
A book. I remember the book.
Remember the book, yes. And came back. On my way around the world, I discovered France. And fell absolutely in love with France. I fell absolutely in love with Japan, too. And I decided that one of those places I was going to pursue cuisine. And I went back to France. I went back to the United States. I saved money and went back to France to live. And that's where I worked and studied cooking. And that's how I learned about cooking.
You and I were talking about how lucky we were to hit on something that became really popular. We were ahead of the game with food. I mean, if we had done something else.
Or if we had tried to get into food now.
Now it would be tough.
It would be tough. It would be very hard to get into it. And I was thinking of my brother, who's a lawyer, and he's a very successful lawyer. And he said, a lot of the reason I'm successful is I got into it at the right time. He got into it in the 70s.
Really?
So it wasn't...
So today you can't do that?
Well, it would be much harder. The hours would be worse. It would be harder to get ahead in it. And it would be the same. It would be equivalent, I suppose.
Now, did you ever do anything with Japan?
No, I never went back.
So what's going to happen with that? Is that in the future?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to learn Japanese, and that's pretty daunting.
Oh, you never knew Japanese?
No, I never spoke Japanese. I was learning it while I was there. Learning bits and pieces of it, but I never really studied it. And there's no way to study it by reading. I taught myself French by reading. You have to know the characters, all those characters. I couldn't possibly do that.
Okay. Well, James, we're going to have to let you go because you're going to have to practice orange tweel.
All right.
You're going to have to go back to basics. But in the meantime, it was a delight to catch up with you.
Well, Peter, thank you. Anne, thank you.
And, as I said, we've interviewed you so many times, and I'd never seen you before. And it's really nice connecting a face to the words.
Well, it's very nice to meet you in person, too.
And the books that I keep on my shelf as really fabulous reference books.
Well, thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, here we are again, and boy, we were busy there.
As you said, as I would typically say, so there you have it.
Right.
An on-the-menu program for another Sunday. We'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.